Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today my guest is my fellow Tottenham Hotspur supporter, good friend and Professor of Intensive Care Medicine at University College London, Mervyn Singer. Professor Singer is a Londoner through and through, born here, educated here, works here, and as I said, supports a London football team. He is an author of peer-reviewed articles and textbooks, a loved teacher and admired lecturer, a thoughtful academic, but above all, a dedicated and accomplished clinician. He also serves as director of the Centre for Intensive Care Medicine of the Wolfson Institute for Biomedical Research. He's served as a senior investigator for the National Institutes of Health Research and received grants from auspicious groups like the Wellcome Trust and European Union Medical Research Council. It is truly a pleasure to welcome my friend, Professor Mervyn Singer, to the podcast. Hi, Mervyn.
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you. Thank you for the intro.
So all spot on. And actually, I could have talked for about 45 minutes just about your accomplishments. But let's start right at the beginning. I'm always intrigued. We didn't know each other back in medical school days, and we're of the same vintage. What kind of medical student were you? And were you sort of a very thoughtful and academic chap when you were going through your training?
I think the simple answer is au contraire. I remember being told in my first week at medical school that you don't learn medicine till you qualify. And while that's not strictly true, there is a fair amount to that. And I actually took that point to heart. And I was encouraged to go and enjoy myself and spread my wings in various directions. So basically, I was intent upon having a good time doing lots of things, broadening my education in many ways, but at the same time, just doing enough to get 51 in every test. So I certainly didn't star academically, but I was bright enough to do just enough work to get me through each exam without having to retake.
So the old joke goes, what do you call the person who graduates bottom of their medical school class? And the response is, of course, doctor. I know when you and I were at medical school, it was far more episodic. And today there's this sort of perpetual evaluation, which I think would make it harder for those folks like me who were episodic in their studies. So what about when you went into your postgraduate training? Did you suddenly flip and become Mr. Diligent and the academic researcher?
Again, no. Because I hadn't been exposed to research, I never actually appreciated what delights it held in store. And so very much I pursued a sort of clinical training route. I didn't quite know what I wanted to be. And I thought, well, my personality doesn't suit a fixed routine, being sat in an office or whatever. So I like variation. Again, I liked acute medicine. You know, I got the adrenaline junkie rush of trying to work out what was going on with a sick person in front of me and then trying to rationalize an appropriate management plan. And intensive care, again, it wasn't very well formed in those days. It was largely achieved or entered through an anaesthetic route. But again, my personality, I didn't think suited me to being an anaesthetist, where essentially you've got 5 minutes of relative panic and then 2-3 hours of boredom while the surgeon laboriously puts in a stitch or chops out a bit of bowel. No disrespect, Jonathan. Indeed. So it was very much following a clinical line. And then by chance, I was working at a small hospital on the northern edge of London. And I'd come from a university hospital where I'd been putting in Swan-Ganz catheters and things to do sophisticated monitoring of the circulation, moved to this little hospital where basically they didn't have the technology. And quite rightly, they said, well, it's all right if you can do it, but when you're not here, what then happens? You're going to teach every doctor, every nurse. And it was a valid point. And my boss at the time came across a small article that he'd read in The Lancet about this non-invasive type of monitoring. And he said, oh, you might be interested in this. And I followed up the lead. And again, serendipity comes into force here. The guy who'd invented the technique was actually working at a research institute about 5 miles away. And I rang him up and he was literally a few months short of retiring. So I went there. He gave me his, or he lent me his sort of Heath Robinson bit of kit. And I went up and tried it out. And these were in the days where there weren't the sort of regulations and controls and requirements that there are now. And
you mean about bringing new developments from the bench into the clinical environment?
Indeed. Nowadays, you're looking at, well, years of regulation, red tape, etc., to get anything from the bench to the bedside of a patient. In those days, it was literally put the device in the back of my car, and it was non-invasive and harmless, so it didn't carry risk as such. But in those days, there just wasn't that degree of regulation. And, you know, I tried it out and hey, it worked. And then I pursued it. And then one thing led to another. And the guy I'd worked for in the aforementioned university hospital, he was actually into that technology in a different way. But I just bumped into him in a meeting. And one thing led to another. And he basically found some money for me to research and develop an idea which uses technology as a sort of continuous monitor. And essentially that then got adopted by a company, and it's now in 30 countries around the world.
And this is a hemodynamic. This is to measure, for non-medical listeners, to measure. Well, explain it, Mervyn.
Yeah. So essentially it uses sound waves, so like radar speed traps that the police use. So it's a Doppler effect. And it can look at the velocity with which blood's being pumped out of the heart. And then that can be translated into the actual volume that the heart is pumping out. And you also get lots of other information. Is the heart pumping weakly or strongly? Is it well filled or not? Is there a high resistance it has to pump against? So it gives lots and lots of information. And it's very readily achieved within literally a minute or two. My bright idea to make it into a continuous monitor was to have a probe that goes into the gullet, the esophagus, and it just sits there. So, you know, in fact, our nurses actually now put the probe into the patient, and they use it, obviously, as well as the doctors, to titrate drugs, fluids, etc. So it's a simple device, but obviously has lots of application, and it's used quite a lot in the operating theatre environment.
Absolutely. And the buzz you got out of that, about basically seeing an idea being translated from your brain to seeing it deployed in clinical practice and helping save people's lives, that's pretty damn satisfying, right?
Oh, completely. You know, it gives a buzz because, yes, the altruistic thing of wanting to help people, which I think clearly you go into medicine with that in mind, hopefully you should, but at the same time, you know, it's nice to see an idea come to fruition, and it's like your little baby that you've nurtured.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned when you were going through your training that the route into the intensive care unit to be the capo di tutti capi in the intensive care unit was through anesthesia. And for the benefit of some people who don't know this, you know, when you're doing an abdominal operation or a chest operation, there's always a sterile drape that separates the surgical field from the work that the anesthetist is doing. And we ironically call this the blood-brain barrier, because we as surgeons are the blood and the chaps up the top end are the ones with the brains. And of course, they're looking after the patient's brain. But you didn't want to do anesthesia. Was there a route to the ICU in those days, or did you kind of make it up?
Well, again, serendipity comes to the fore. So essentially, as I was finishing my research on this Doppler, this hemodynamic monitoring device, there was one job in the whole of the UK that was an academic post for somebody doing intensive care or to train in intensive care and medicine. And the incumbent of that post had found a promotion job post there literally at the time I was finishing. So I was perfectly placed to apply for it and thus came to University College.
But of course, nowadays, it's far more of a standardized route into intensivist. Although, you know, in the States, I worked closely with a chap who had come into intensive care through surgery and described himself as a surgical intensivist. And there are still people who go through the anesthetic route. So it's an interesting and evolving field. Tell me, Mervyn, you've always struck me as such a positive chap, even at, you know, we're now in the midst of this wretched pandemic, even when stressed, you come across as positive. How do you explain that?
I think partly it's in my genes. You know, I've always been positive. And I think also I realised at an early point in my career that you can be passionate about something, but again, it's how you cope with stress is actually important, because if you get yourself stressed, then it's counterproductive, because the only person that then gets harmed is yourself. And so it's a case of, you know, remaining committed, passionate, determined. You want to do the right thing and hopefully use yourself as a good example for others to follow. And so I remain sort of good-natured and good-humoured and smiley. So therefore, when I look irritated, then people know that I've become irritated about something. And so I very, very, very rarely lose my temper. But usually, you know, it's transmitting the irritation that people think, we've upset him. Why have we upset him? And so therefore it just keeps the stress levels down. And so I bore everyone to tears with anecdotes and jokes and bad jokes.
I think that's one of the reasons why we get along. I've found that the same strategy applies. There was a colleague of mine, I will not say which hospital, and I had a hard time with this guy. He was a great surgeon, but a difficult character. And he said to me, "Why do you always seem to get a much earlier start time than I do? And why, if you do an add-on case, do they tend to slide it through and I have to wait around?" So it's really very, very simple. I come in the morning, bring a box of donuts for the operating theatre nurses, offer if I can help clean the room between cases. You come in and start scowling and shouting at people. It's not complicated, is it?
Yeah, completely, completely. My equivalent to the donuts is fresh bagels on a Sunday morning.
There you go, when you bring coming to do rounds. So, Mervyn, you're a very, very good speaker, have a very animated style, and you just need to peruse conference proceedings and see what people say about you. Where did that come from? Are you a bit of a showman?
Yes, I suppose. Brutally honest, yes. No, I think, again, it's my personality is more towards the extrovert, outspoken mold. And again, going back to my medical student days that I was mentioning earlier, it was very much about discovering other facets to develop. And I got into amateur dramatics. So I became a scion of the Amateur Dramatic Society and had a lovely time. So, you know, we did 2-3 performances a year. We did musicals, dramas, comedies, reviews. And, you know, I just loved it. And, you know, it's a wonderful feeling when you've got the words and you have the emotion, or you can, as it were, manipulate the audience's emotions to make them laugh, to make them cry, to shock them. And you're just saying the words, but hopefully delivering them. And you get this great buzz as to when you get that sense back from the audience that, yeah, they're with you, they're following you.
Well, any kind of whether it's teaching within medical school, on the podium, or it's on a news program, it doesn't matter how good your information is. If you can't deliver it, it almost doesn't matter. So maybe amateur dramatics ought to be a part of medical school.
Indeed. The other thing, I'll tell you another tip. I once did an educational video, and the sound man was moonlighting from his normal day job at the BBC. And so he told me afterwards, he said, you speak in a very interesting way. And I said, oh, why is that? And he said, well, most Brits or English people sort of take a big breath at the beginning of a sentence and then go down, 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 down. And so you finish on a down. Whereas he said, you're more like an Italian, so you breathe in the middle and go up at the end of a sentence. And he said, it's more melodic and it makes it more interesting to listen to. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And, you know, because obviously it was natural. I hadn't worked on it. But, you know, having that cadence in your voice, having rhythms, etc. And, you know, and it's true. It's sort of, when you listen to an Italian, it's such a beautiful language to listen to.
But it's the delivery right as well.
Yeah.
You know, when I was at the Hammersmith, the guy who was the chairman of surgery, the professor of surgery, Les Blumgard, used to run these grand rounds, which was actually just a series of lectures and talks. But he would sit at the front with the controls for the house lights. And if he didn't like your delivery, let alone your material, he'd turn the lights on and send you to his office. And, you know, he was a bit of a stentorian character, a heck of a personality and a very good surgeon. But he had some rules, like no more than 7 lines on a slide. Don't read what's on the slide. The slide is an aid memoir. I just think that some of our colleagues could really do with a bit of media training. You know, sometimes going to a lecture or a conference is, my goodness, it's a good cure for insomnia.
Death by PowerPoint.
Death by PowerPoint, absolutely. Should be banned. I want to talk a little bit about the management of an ICU. In different places I've worked, the responsibility, the ultimate responsibility for management of patients varies. And I must admit, being a surgeon, if one of my patients needed the intensive care unit, I wanted to remain very involved and have my name, if you will, on the end of the bed. So people knew it's my responsibility. But obviously, following the guidance of the intensivist, some places, which I won't mention, I found to be rather dictatorial. You come into my ICU, these are my patients. I prefer a collaborative approach. What are your thoughts about the different ways of doing it? What works best?
Yeah, no, I'm of very similar mind. It's that middle ground. I think trust comes into it. So you've got to trust the surgeon, and the surgeon hopefully has to trust you. So I'm not going to tell you how to operate, but at the same time, hopefully my grasp of physiology and monitoring and stuff should be better than the average surgeon. So The idea is that we work together as a team and we respect each other's space. So the surgeon doesn't interfere too much. He's obviously, he or she, I should say, is obviously very welcome to comment or query what I'm doing. And hopefully I should have a good rationale explanation as to what I'm doing and why. But at the same time, they should defer to my expertise to hopefully do my bits of the patient. And at the same time, there should be the expectation from the surgeon that, yes, we should communicate. If I'm worried about something that obviously pertains to the surgeon, they should be contacted and we have that discussion. And again, to try and encourage the rapport and the communication and try and make sure the surgeon comes regularly to review his or her patient.
So maybe along with doing amateur dramatics at med school, we should also teach communication skills and negotiation skills.
United Nations.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just the way that I know in certain disciplines, I mean, in cardiac surgery, cardiac surgeons very often view themselves as technologists. You know, the cardiologist refers the patient, they operate, and an intensivist looks after the patient postoperatively. I, as a surgeon, would struggle enormously with devolving responsibility. You know, I'm the night after an operation, I'm playing through the procedure in my mind and thinking about every single maneuver, every stitch, and agitating, did I do the right thing here, 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 and here? So let's look at one particular area, which I know you're very, very well versed in. And I'll give you a background. I was at a medical investment conference, and after at one session, there was a very acerbic investment analyst who was really brutal towards a presenter whose company was working on a sepsis diagnostic. And he described sepsis as where good money goes to die, because there have been precious few real advances in the field and a lot of false starts. It's an area, as I said, that you're very well versed in, and I know you've received top tier research funding, you chaired the International Sepsis Forum. People even argue about what sepsis is. So educate us on definitions and what are the areas that are showing promise and threat.
Right. Well, sepsis is a term that has been abused for hundreds of years and probably more so in the last 10 or 20 years. So essentially, the way I describe it is that many of us get infections. We spend our life being exposed to viruses, bacteria, etc., and we get an infection, and usually the body's really, really good at dealing with it. So most of the time we have a cold or a paronychia on a finger or whatever, a wound that gets infected, and it heals itself. Our body heals without the need to go to a doctor to get antibiotic or get drainage of the abscess or whatever. A proportion will need to come into hospital to have that infection managed, but a proportion beyond that, the infection will trigger an abnormal response by the body where the body actually acts upon itself. So you get a dysregulated, exaggerated host response where the body turns against its own organs, and then these organs shut down, become dysfunctional, and that's when you need intensive care to prop up the failing lungs so you're on a ventilator, prop up the failing kidneys so you're on a kidney machine, a dialysis type machine, prop up the blood pressure because it often becomes quite saggy. So you need drugs to help increase the blood pressure. So that multi-organ failure is when infection goes bad, and that bad infection, this dysregulated host response, represents sepsis. So moving on from that, only a tiny proportion of the whole gamut of patients who get infection actually end up in an intensive care unit. But clearly, you know, it's a very high risk condition. Many people die from it. So we're still, despite years of effort trying to find out magic cures, you're still looking at mortality rates running between, again, depending on the severity of the patient at presentation, anything from 20 to 60%. And we've made some progress in recent years, but we're still a long way from finding the magic bullet. And I think nowadays there's much more emphasis on, can we diagnose it earlier? Because clearly, if you can nip it in the bud before it becomes a full-blown major catastrophe, then the chances of reeling the patient back from the precipice are much better. So there's a much greater effort in terms of early diagnostics. And also we're recognizing that one size doesn't fit all. So you can't lump every patient into one big pot and expect the same treatment to work in everyone. So we're trying to learn better how to personalize care, how for certain types of patients with certain biological patterns, you treat them in one way and other patients with other patterns perhaps treat in a different way.
And what of antibiotic resistance? I mean, a lot of the weapons in your armamentarium have been depleted because of antimicrobial resistance.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. Unfortunately, and this is something I actually feel quite passionately about, is that antibiotics are taken to be a panacea for everything. And like any drug, there's good and there's bad. So just giving up antibiotics, even on their own, even appropriately for an infection, there is a side effect profile. There are complications. Some are overt. They can cause rashes, allergic reactions, kidney problems, etc. But many of the complications related to antibiotics are covert. We don't actually see directly the problems, but they're there in the background and can actually cause harm. So because they're viewed as this huge panacea, patients are just doled out by their clinicians, their doctors, antibiotics. A lot of the time, the patients don't even have an infection or perhaps didn't even need an antibiotic, and yet they're given them. And as a result, you know, bugs are clever and they adapt, and they adapt to the environment they're in. And they think, okay, if this bug isn't going to kill me, I'm going to beat the drug and become resistant to it. And especially, well, Asia, Africa and the United States have huge problems now with increasing antimicrobial resistance. I know New York, for example, is an example of a very bad problem, I should say. They have many patients who come into hospital already with multi-resistant bugs. So the options to treating them are far diminished. And again, our ability to rapidly diagnose the right antibiotic for that particular bug in terms of the susceptibility is diminishing. So, or it's poor at the moment. And so if your options are diminishing, the likelihood of treating the patient with an effective antibiotic gets smaller. And obviously the risk to the patient in terms of survival becomes worse.
So this is something that I've discussed on a number of occasions with other guests. And horrifyingly, the vast majority of antibiotics are not actually even used in human disease. They're used in feedlots, and humans are consuming them by consuming feedlot meat and chicken and such like, and fish. And what we actually need to do is to change our farming practices as well as our medical practices. And I think if people in the general public, especially now in the time of COVID, where there are images of what it looks like to be on an intensive care, because most non-medical people have never seen that, maybe they would be a little bit more receptive to changing the way we farm. Does that make sense to you, Mervyn?
Yeah, I'm partially in agreement, you know, and intuitively, yes, is the answer. Although I've heard an interesting counterblast by, actually, it was a vet, because he argued that giving antibiotics means that the animals are cleaner, they grow better. So one of the reasons chickens and so forth are given antibiotics is they grow to a much larger size. Ergo, you can feed more of the world's population per chicken, as it were. And so he was actually making a very impassioned plea that actually antibiotics do have benefits for the food chain and increasing food availability. Now, your point is absolutely well taken that, you know, we are perhaps endangering future generations by using up all of our resource and causing antibiotic resistance. So I think it's a bit like the current dilemma with COVID. You've got the risk to the healthcare of the population versus the economic risk. And how do you trade one off against the other?
Well, let's dig into COVID. It's been a game changer in many, many ways. So let's start with Mervyn Singer. What's the pandemic taught you and taught us, I guess, as doctors?
I think it's taught us that, yes, we can respond. I think hopefully people look at their own performance and can evaluate how they coped, how they dealt with the stress of COVID. You know, just doing intensive care, by definition, I've been in the front line. And it's been very illuminating to see how people have stood up to the plate. And the vast majority have actually stood up to the plate. And it's been actually quite fulfilling to see how people have pulled together and helped. And intensive care is very much a multidisciplinary specialty, so we could not survive without a huge amount of input from nursing staff, pharmacists, physiotherapists, etc. So, you know, we're just one part of that team. And the way people have pushed themselves, I think, is actually quite staggering. I think there are, unfortunately, and, you know, now reports are coming through into the media of the effects of this stress on people. You know, about somebody, there was a report in the UK the other day about how intensive care staff are reporting levels of stress, which is way above what soldiers experience in military conflicts. And, you know, half of the nurses and doctors quizzed were complaining of not being able to sleep, depression, becoming tearful, manifestations of post-traumatic stress disorder. So I think there's also this recognition that we've got to look after ourselves.
But you say your experience is that people have responded very well. And yeah, based on what I know, I would concur. You know, the problem with having an ever-present media, and in fact, now everyone's a journalist with access to the internet, there's some benefits, but there's a lot of negatives. And the thing that's driving me crazy are these conspiracy theorists who I think are very, very dangerous. You know, this is a plandemic. It's caused by 5G, the government, or some other crazy conspiracy theory. How do you react when you hear one of these? I get angry. I tend to get angry and go into my sort of lecture mode and tell people why it's bonkers. I don't know that that's the best way to deal with it. What do you think?
Again, going back to our earlier discussion, you know, I very rarely get angry. I get frustrated. I think, you know, it's our duty to educate. And actually, we were in the UK, the first hospital to allow the BBC into our intensive care unit, because they were very keen to show the public what life was actually like in an intensive care unit in the middle of a COVID pandemic. There was a sort of reticence from the powers that be in government and the higher echelons of the Department of Health to have that. But thankfully, our hospital agreed. And, you know, there was a very, very powerful piece that came out, and it was like headline on the main news. And it was a very prolonged piece, which actually resonated very strongly with the public. And all of a sudden, the penny dropped that this wasn't, COVID wasn't just a cough or a cold. People were becoming critically ill and dying and struggling, and their families were suffering, and it had a huge effect on the staff. And so, yes, you can be a denier, but unfortunately, you know, look in the mirror. If you got COVID, would you be happy not to be treated in a hospital? I think the answer is not. You know, so I think there needs to be responsibility. And I think the exposure of what's happening is crucial. And, you know, it's the world we live in. Fake news does abound. And I think we have a duty to try and educate, and just try and impress upon people that this is reality.
Well, I think that was actually a very responsible thing to do. There's an American intensivist, I don't know if you saw this, blanking on which hospital he was in, but he put out a little piece, a video, which was a view of him as if he were lying on a bed and he's holding a laryngoscope and an ET tube. And he says, don't let this be the last thing you see, because this is what you'll see if I'm going to intubate you. And it was, you know, basically, please be socially responsible. Please take the steps to limit the spread of this virus. I thought it was actually a very, very powerful and very clever piece. So, yeah, approaching the public with an educational perspective is a good thing. Now, one of the good things that came out of this, and you hinted at it, is how well people have worked to innovate. Tell us about the journey to develop the CPAP device, the ventilatory assist device that you were involved with.
That's a nice story. Long story short, when obviously the pandemic began in Wuhan in China and then moved to Italy, and I've got lots of mates in China and Italy, and basically I was hearing what they were going through, and it did not sound pretty. I had an Italian friend describe his intensive care unit to me as a war zone, and I thought, oh, this is Italian melodramatics, but he was absolutely right, as I found out a few weeks later. But our government and Department of Health, and I think basically they hadn't really been finding out what was happening on the front line in China, Italy, etc., and they recognised that patients were becoming critically ill, needing to go onto ventilators. So they thought, oh, we just need more ventilators. So let's go from the current number of 4,000 in the UK. And the modelling suggested they'd need 30,000. When I heard this, I groaned because I thought we struggle at the moment with intensive care nurses in particular to look after 4,000. To look after 30,000 would be an impossibility. We just couldn't physically do it. There had to be alternatives. CPAP is a sort of non-invasive respiratory support that keeps people, you know, it gives more support than just an oxygen mask, but doesn't mean you have to be put to sleep and have a tube put down your throat and connected to a ventilator, a breathing machine. And I thought this is what we needed. However, when we went out to try and buy some, there were none to be bought because the whole world was trying to buy machines. Our engineers at UCL had been approached. There was this ventilator challenge. So Boris Johnson had come up with a bright idea to invoke the Second World War spirit of, you know, British industry innovating and building Spitfire aeroplanes, that we could do the same for ventilators. So Rolls-Royce and Dyson and Airbus, big marquee British companies, could make ventilators from scratch in a few weeks to save the British public. Again, in my view, this is completely misguided because a ventilator is a sophisticated machine and patients with COVID who have respiratory failure need sophisticated ventilators, and so you're never going to be able to build and develop these in a few weeks, let alone a few months. Our engineers were asked to be involved in trying to help set up consortia, and I was quite adamant to say, this is the wrong approach. We don't want to put people on a ventilator, and we certainly haven't got the time to wait for companies to make sophisticated machines. I basically said we need something simple like a CPAP device, but we need it to be made quickly. And years ago, in the good old days when we didn't have fancy machines that had blinking lights and lots of alarms, we used very simple machines that plugged into an oxygen supply in the wall. And I said, we need something like this. And basically the engineer said, well, we can reverse engineer it. We can make it. And one of the engineers used to work in the Formula One racing car world, and he had very good links, and so the chief engineer at Mercedes Formula One, or the people that make the engines, it's a Mercedes subsidiary in the middle of England, the chief engineer was his PhD student, so he rang him, the engineer rang his boss, and the following day, four engineers were sent down to UCL to work with the UCL engineers, and they turned over their whole plant. They have 800 odd people working there towards making CPAP machines. And we found one in the anaesthetic department museum. The Mercedes guy sourced another one off eBay for £50. And I kid you not, quite an amazing feat that they reverse engineered. They did metals analysis or materials analysis, CT scans. They'd worked out the flows, everything that you'd put into a Formula One engine, they applied to this device. And within 2 days, they'd actually come out with a perfect working prototype. I was staggered, you know, and it was beautiful. And it was literally a carbon copy of the original in 2 days. And I tried it and a colleague tried it on ourselves and it worked. We then, you know, the regulatory body in the UK were brilliant. Literally, you know, we got it regulated within a few weeks. We then managed to persuade the powers that be in government and Department of Health that this was the solution, and people were turning more and more towards using CPAP to keep people off ventilators. So we had an order of 10,000 commissioned, and within a month of having the original idea, 10,000 devices were delivered to the Department of Health, which is quite staggering, and due credit to our engineers and to the Mercedes Formula One people. They were just phenomenal. The ability to just deliver this at pace was just gobsmackingly brilliant, and it just showed me what could be done. Again, we're used, and I'm sure, Jonathan, you've experienced this too, we're used to a snail's pace in terms of development, and these sort of just-in-time type of companies who have to work at pace to deliver solutions. So the Formula One industry, they have to make modifications for the next race. They're used to working at pace, adapting, modifying, they're flexible, and gosh, did they deliver. The other thing I think, which is personally, and I think we've all found very gratifying, is that it shouldn't just be for the UK. And so we made the designs open source, all about the plans, the manufacturing, etc. A whole load of companies and organizations worldwide have taken on the plans, and I think now they're being made in 20 countries around the world.
That's wonderful. It does beg the question, hopefully in the not too distant future, this pandemic will be behind us. It'd be really nice if we didn't go back to business as usual and the snail's pace of development, and we understand that yes, you can develop things quickly. Yes, you can clear things through the regulatory pathways quickly. Yes, you can deploy things quickly and more kindly, because we're all one nation globally and we have to look after each other. You know, Mervyn, there's so many aspects about this that I'd love to discuss with you, but we are time limited. So I'm going to finish with a question that I love to ask everyone who I have on the podcast. If you awoke tomorrow to discover that you were in charge of healthcare for the world, and you cannot get all humble on me, you have to answer this, right? What three things would you do to improve global health?
Good question. Three things. Okay. I think, well, clearly at the moment, we're not going to get to equality because the world is an unequal place, but I think we should aim for equity. And so I think, again, much as I promote intensive care, I think more lives can be saved with hygiene, vaccination, good nutrition. So I think my emphasis would be to make sure, and I think thankfully things are happening on the vaccination front now that is widespread across, you know, low, middle income countries. And that should be a uniform requirement that every child should be vaccinated. There should be good sanitation. There should be good nutrition. So that would be, I think, my number one aim. My number two aim, I think there needs to be better coordination. We have a World Health Organization. And again, my dealings with the CPAP machine, we tried going through the WHO to try and get this disseminated. And oh my goodness, are they bureaucratic? It just pains me to say that their response to COVID could have been far, far, far more active and aggressive. And I think, you know, there's a lot of lip service, for example, vaccines. You know, yes, it's important to give the whole world vaccines, but all of the major industrial companies are busy trying to buy as many vaccines as they can for their local population. So you can understand fully why there is this nationalism, but at the same time, you know, we do have a responsibility for the world. Third point, I think information. I think there's a lot of stuff that needs to be transmitted around the world, and education is key to that. And clearly, you've got to tailor the education to the current facilities. I was quite shocked, when this came out, to find out how many countries around the world, how many hospitals around the world even lack a basic oxygen supply.
Yeah.
Which is a tragedy in this day and age that many, many hospitals lack rudimentary, fundamental things like oxygen, syringes. They have to sterilize or re-sterilize syringes because they haven't got the wherewithal. So apart from the equity argument, I think we need to tailor education and stuff to make sure we're not imposing Western type technologies and ideas on countries that simply can't deliver. So I think that we have an important role to try and improve upon.
Yeah, well, those are wonderful thoughts. And why should I be surprised coming from you? Professor Mervyn Singer, my dear chap, it's been a delight talking to you on the podcast today. I look forward to getting together in person, however, as soon as the pandemic rules allow, and hopefully going to see our beloved team play again in person. And then we can have something in the grand scheme of things a little bit less important to be slightly irritated by. Mervyn, thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been a great pleasure, as always.
Well, that's it for today, folks. I hope you've enjoyed this discussion as much as I have. And if so, please tell your friends about the podcast, like us on social media, and feel free to email me at drjonathansakia@gmail.com with suggestions on topics you want me to cover. And remember, listen in next Friday to the EMG Health Podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. Bye for now. Stay safe. Stay well.